child. Rachel Lee needed just a bit more time. By the time of the miscarriage, she had concluded the liquidation of Raines's property, draining the once prosperous farm of all resources. On February 19, 2015, the 67-year-old Raines took the stand. He appeared baffled and distraught, not quite comprehending what had happened. "I thought I was married to a person named Mary Marks. I don't know where she's at," he told the court. And he wasn't quite ready to believe what people were telling him. "For reasons of my own, I'm just going to wear the ring." Lee was sentenced to 8 years and 4 months in prison. Her daughter, Portia, the 25-year-old Raines had known as Mary Marks, pleaded guilty to co-conspiracy. Her sentence, 2 years and 10 months. Blancy Lee would serve 2 years. It wasn't at the trial alone that Raines acted as if he were in denial. In the decade that he had been enmeshed with the Lees, he had heard warnings of disaster. At a local event that he attended with Rachel Lee, several friends voiced their skepticism. And when he attended his high school reunion with Mary in 2010, his cousin Karen Fenimore expressed shock. She had no idea he was married. Before, she later told prosecutors, she had been in the habit of stopping by her house every week or two for a friendly chat. But the interactions had gradually decreased. She felt he was being isolated from his support network, and that couldn't have been good. There were as well the more concrete signs. His child, for one, looked nothing like him. Raines chose to ignore it all. He could have gotten out, but things seemed to be going so well. And so he did what was easier, kept right on believing. It wasn't until bank officials expressed concern about some of the financial transactions being conducted in his name that the police became involved. Had it been up to Raines, he might have kept believing until the end. It would have been a simpler, happier reality. And that basic desire for a happier, simpler reality is at the center of the convincer's success. As information from our environment comes in, we home in on the positive and tend to isolate and filter out the negative. That selective perception makes us more empathetic, happier, better able to care for others, more productive, and more creative. When we receive negative feedback, we can usually deal with it because we rationalize it's not really our fault. We are good at what we do. It's just that this time, things went a bit awry. And even if we don't rationalize, it's easier to take the bad when you think yourself capable. Yes, I messed up, but I'll be able to make it work. But that selective filter also makes us far more likely to attribute Miller's 10% returns not to something strange, but rather to our own acumen in choosing investments. Since it is the result of our good judgment, it will continue indefinitely, rather than come to an end the moment the environment changes. If we're expecting something to work, we will see evidence for its working, even in ambiguous circumstances. Are Miller's returns the result of astonishingly savvy investments? Or are they coming from somewhere else? If the money is coming in as promised, we don't dig too deeply into why. We just assume he's a brilliant investor. Isn't that why we invested with him? Take the stock market. We have reams and reams of data on its performance over time. Charts, trends, cycles of boom and bust, expected returns, and the like. But when things are going well, it's tough to convince even the savviest of investors that they may soon enough turn south. When, during the 1998 bull market, investors were asked to predict their annual return for the following year, they guessed an equally bullish 14%. Over the next 10 years, they grew even more optimistic, estimating 17.4% average annual returns, even though the long-term base for U.S. stocks is between 10 and 11%, a fact of which, presumably, traders and investment professionals are well aware. It's one of the reasons that, time and again, bubbles will swell, in the markets on the whole or in certain sectors, and then, just as fabulously, burst. Everyone realizes in theory that the downturn will happen. In practice, though, it never seems to be quite the moment for it. After all, things are going so well. The convincer is precisely that, wholly convincing. Why quit while you're ahead if you are certain you'll remain ahead in the future? The ebullient optimism that doesn't see its own demise isn't a function of modern markets either. It's far older and more pervasive than that. One of the most famous bubbles in history was the great Dutch tulip mania, Tulpenvode, of the early 17th century. So desired were the flowers, and so high their price, that in the 1630s a sailor was jailed for mistaking one for an onion and eating it. While the story is likely apocryphal, the sentiment is not. At the bubble's peak in 1637, some bulbs had increased in price 20-fold in a 3-month period. Semper Augustus, considered particularly desirable, cost about 1,000 guilders in the 1620s. In the weeks before the crash, it sold for the cost of a luxury house in Amsterdam, 5,500 guilders. In February, the market crashed. Such is the nature of speculation, and such is the nature of our endless optimism. If we're not expecting it, it won't happen. And if we are, it will. The convincer needs no further evidence than the momentary success it seems to provide. Though few people would think of bubbles as confidence schemes, the line between bubble and con can be a very fine one. They operate on many of the same principles, occur for many of the same reasons, and are so incredibly persistent, despite past evidence, based on much the same rationale. And sometimes it can be incredibly difficult to tell the one from the other. One man's bubble may well be another man's con. In 1714, John Law arrived in Paris. Tall and elegant, with a passion reserved in equal parts for women and gambling, Law soon installed himself at Place Louis le Grand, a glamorous square in the heart of the first arrondissement that boasted the highest echelons of society as residents. Today, it's better known as the Place Vendôme, home of the Ritz-Carlton and the Hôtel de Vendôme. Soon after his arrival, Law received an appointment at the Bank of Amsterdam. He had been a noted economist back in Scotland, trained by his banker father, and had a way of making himself liked in the highest of places. In due course, Law was gambling alongside the likes of the Duke of Orléans, France's future regent. The Duke took to the colorful Scotsman. Here was a man, he thought, who knew how to be serious with the best of them, but didn't take himself too seriously. He had hobnobbed with the most learned minds of Europe, from Amsterdam to Venice, but he knew how to be the perfect guest and most charming conversant. At the time, France was mired in debt. Louis XIV had racked up some 2 billion livres in the currency of the time to pay for his wars and his whims. Precious metal was scarce and new coins hard to come by. When the king died, leaving a 5-year-old heir, the duke assumed the regency. Overwhelmed by the nation's financial quagmire, the duke asked his old financial wizard of a friend for advice. Law soon assumed control of the Banque Générale, and was shortly thereafter appointed Controller General of the country. He had a plan. For years, he'd been advocating a system of central banking in which paper currency, backed by a reserve of gold and silver, would serve as the medium of exchange, thus making the financial system more elastic. Today, that seems like business as usual. It's how we operate, at least in theory. Back then, it was quite revolutionary. There was no paper money in circulation. Everything was transacted in precious metal. Paper, though, would increase the monetary supply and, Law hoped, stimulate trade and commerce, getting France out of its slump. Law established a trading company, the Mississippi Company, that would engage in exchange with the colonies. People could buy shares and raise money, the company would trade for important goods and precious metals, and the economy would get a much-needed stimulus. What happened next has been debated ever since. One thing is certain. The shares in the Mississippi Company collapsed in 1720, after rising to an all-time high the year prior. A few discerning investors saw that more and more shares were being issued, and more money printed with little to show for it. It was a system feeding on itself. And so some, notably two prominent princes, decided to cash out. Others soon followed suit. Shares were worth a great deal, so why not collect the hard cash now? Quickly, Law printed some 1.5 million livres to cover the conversions. But soon people wanted coin, not paper bills. The Banque Royale, as it was subsequently called, collapsed under the demand. Law himself was forced to flee the country, dressed as a beggar to avoid capture. He died in Vienna 8 years later of pneumonia, poor and friendless. Some people see John Law as a master con man, someone who brought France to the verge of financial collapse by selling worthless stock in a sham trading company. As one rhyme of the time goes, "My shares, which on Monday I bought, were worth millions on Tuesday, I thought. So on Wednesday I chose my abode. In my carriage on Thursday I rode. To the ballroom on Friday I went. To the workhouse next day I was sent." Or, as one nobleman put it, "Thus ends the system of paper money, which has enriched 1,000 beggars and impoverished 100,000 men." As late as 1976, when J. Robert Nash published his history of the con, Hustlers and Conmen, he listed Law among the game's most polished practitioners. In October 2014, John Steele Gordon, a prominent business and financial historian, called Law's the greatest scam of all time. But today many would argue that Law was no confidence artist. He had a theoretically sound scheme, but got caught up in the bubble mentality. He thought he could continue to issue and print indefinitely as he consolidated his trading companies and set the whole thing in motion. Confidence would remain high because it was high already, and the share price would continue to rise because, well, it had never fallen in the past. So was he a hustler or merely unlucky? Ultimately, we'll never know. It is, for the most part, a question of knowledge and intent. Did you seriously want to help the economy, or did you weasel your way into a position you had no business being in, with the knowledge that you could get rich and flee when the going was good? The jury is out. Before his stint in France, back in his homeland, Scotland, Law had run his father's banking firm into the ground in pursuit of an extravagant gambling habit, and was later sentenced to death for his role in a love duel. He escaped to Amsterdam and later returned to Scotland. By the time he made his way to the French court, his proposals had already been rejected by Scotland and Amsterdam. France looked an awful lot like the ideal con victim. The nation was mired in debt and close to bankruptcy. It would try anything. And for a while, Law did seem to be making headway. Those who were poor now prospered. Those who had clamored for revolution were now satisfied. Who's to say the good times couldn't keep coming? The convincer is all about getting your mark to dedicate himself to his commitment for the long haul. And, willful con artist or not, Law certainly knew how to play the part well. There is a thin line between a reformer ahead of his time and a savvy con artist who knows how to exploit optimism about the future. Up until the last moment, France and its people kept piling more and more resources into the scheme. How could it burst when it had all gone so smoothly? It's simply how our minds so often work. We cannot fathom failure in light of success. Well, we can fathom it. We just don't really think it's going to happen. Not yet, not now, not to us. Our optimism in the future runs ever strong. So strong, in fact, that we often create the illusion of successful outcomes ourselves, even without the sorts of cash incentives a Miller or a Law or a Madoff offers. We see a con going well and read our desires into ambiguous signs to convince ourselves that we've invested wisely, be it money, time, reputation, or any other precious resources. When we want to, we see signs of good fortune everywhere. It's one of the reasons for the famous hot hand fallacy that Cornell University psychologist Thomas Gilovich identified in 1985. Gilovich had first observed the phenomenon among basketball aficionados when they pronounced players on a hot streak or playing with a hot hand. The players and coaches, too, seemed to believe it, even going so far as to select certain draft picks because they were perceived to be playing hot at the time. To Gilovich, the whole thing seemed highly unlikely. He was a cognitive psychologist, studying rationality and its departures, and there was simply no reason to assume that people's talents and skills could show such tremendous, lasting deviations. He'd also been working with Amos Tversky, who, along with Daniel Kahneman, had identified the belief in the law of small numbers some 10 years prior, that we believe that chance rates seen over the long term should also be reflected in the short term, and if they are not, something else must be going on. For instance, since a coin is supposed to land on heads half the time, we expect it to do so if we toss it, say, 10 times. We don't take into consideration the fact that averages are derived over a broader time scale. And so, if we see tails coming up time and time again, we tend to think that we're particularly lucky. Simon Lovell, con artist turned legitimate magician, wrote a book about exploiting such tendencies when you're out on the grift. One of the simplest short cons revolves around getting people to place bets on outcomes they think either highly unlikely or highly likely because of their recent experience, an experience that, in the convincer, is unerringly positive. And then to upend those perfectly reasonable-seeming expectations. In what's called a proposition or prop bet, you first make a claim and then ask for any takers to bet against you. One example, betting that you can tie a cigarette into a knot without tearing the paper. Impossible, right? Anyone would bet against you after trying it a few times on their own. But it's not actually impossible if you first wrap the cigarette tightly in the cellophane from the box and then tie the cellophane. Prop bets take advantage of what we expect and then do something completely different. They take the psychology behind the convincer and exploit it to its logical conclusion. Gilovich and his colleagues decided to test our hot hand-like perceptions by analyzing the shooting records of the Philadelphia 76ers and the Boston Celtics. They failed to find any relationship suggestive of actual hot hands. A player who made one shot was no more likely to make another soon after. Any deviations from their average level of play were the result not of streaks, but of chance. They were to be expected from the probability distributions and were not the result of some magical power that a player suddenly had. But even though the hot hand fallacy has been largely disproven, in 2006 a review of 20 years of data found an overwhelming lack of evidence for the presence of sudden bouts of talent. It continues to govern our thoughts of the future. If a player is on a hot streak, we should give him the proverbial ball because he will make the shot. In hedge funds, Kahneman points out, we see the same thing. When a fund has been tremendously successful for a few years, investors pour in. Success now, even in something as volatile and chance-like as markets, means success always. Often, though, those phenomenal returns evaporate or reverse. It is, after all, a game of chance. Sure, a manager could be quite good, but ultimately he also has to be quite lucky, and luck can often masquerade as talent when the latter is absent. Not only do we get fooled into thinking that just because something is working now, the future will be even better, but we often project our desires onto our estimations of likely success. In other words, we tend to think that what will happen is what we want to happen, especially if the outcome is an important one. It's Paul Frampton's near-certain calculation that Denise Milani will be his wife, Ralph Raines's certainty in a happily ever after with his family, or Oscar Bergstrom's calculation that he can steadily give all his money to William Miller and live off the returns that will, of course, never end. In 1935, Jerome Frank, a psychologist at Harvard University, asked a group of people to perform three separate tasks, each repeated a number of times. The tasks were simple enough. In one, they would have to print a set of words as quickly as possible. In another, pitch rings onto a stick, a game called quoits. And in a third, manipulate a series of shapes in their heads under time pressure. Each time a participant finished a particular task, Frank would let her know how she'd performed and would ask her how well she wanted to do on the next go-around. The better she wanted to perform, he found, the better she'd estimate she would in fact perform in the future, even when that performance was in no way warranted by her past experience. We want our schemes to succeed, our investments to go well, our love life to flourish, our luck to hold, our health and looks to improve. And we will that desire into being. It's perfectly understandable. but it's also how a convincer becomes so convincing, and how a con goes from short to long in a matter of moments. We're working just as hard to convince ourselves as the confidence man is working to convince us. The optimistic illusion applies not only to the con itself, it applies to the con artist. Just as we think, once we've tasted the convincer, that everything is on the level, so we believe that just because someone has been trustworthy, or so we believe, up until now, he will continue to be so in the future. Viktor Lustig was born in Prague in 1890. Early on, it became apparent that the child had tremendous linguistic ability. He wasn't yet out of his teens before he spoke not only Czech, but English, German, Italian, and French. It would prove a useful skill. Lustig's silver tongue became his livelihood. The Count, as he later styled himself, went on to become one of the master confidence men of the early 20th century. It was he who sold the Eiffel Tower to unwitting investors, not once, but twice, convincing them it was to be destroyed for scrap metal. It was also he who created a famed money box that could make perfect copies of $20 bills on demand, yours for the low cost of $4,000, more if you could afford it. One banker was purported to have bought one for $100,000. He'd seed the box's false bottom with real bills, and almost never failed to make a sale. And it was he who managed to get a sheriff who'd arrested him for fraud to purchase a money box of his own. Lustig's reputation preceded him. It was even enough when he found himself in Chicago to gain an audience with the man who ran the whole place, Al Capone. Lustig had, he told the bootlegger, a proposition. If Capone gave him $50,000, he would double his investment within 2 months. Capone was naturally suspicious, but he also had many a hired gun by his side. "Okay, Count," he told him, "double it in 60 days like you said." "Or else," came the implicit threat. Lustig was a smart and cautious man. He liked to live the fine life, but more than that, he liked to live a life, period. He wasn't about to invest Capone's money and risk losing even a penny. That had never been the plan. Instead, he made his way to a safety deposit box, where he left the full amount, and from there traveled to his home base in New York. Over the next few months, Lustig went about his business, and on the promised day he returned to Capone's office. Eagerly, Capone asked for his doubled return. The Count couldn't have been more humbled or apologetic. "Please accept my profound regrets," he told Capone. "I'm sorry to report to you that the plan failed. I failed." He then reached into his pocket, removed the whole of Capone's money, and returned it to the gangster. He'd wanted to make it work, truly, he continued. He needed the cash himself, but the plan had fallen through. Capone was, for the moment, speechless. He had known Lustig was a flimflammer, he said, and he'd expected either a cool $100,000 through some shady scheme or other, or zero. But now the Count had shown him another side of his personality, a side he wouldn't soon forget. "My God, you're honest!" With that, Capone gave Lustig $5,000 to help him along in his financial difficulties. That's all Lustig had ever wanted. Capone was a mighty fine judge of character. Each year, Roderick Kramer teaches a class on negotiation at Stanford's business school. And each time he teaches it, he poses a question. How good are you at judging someone's trustworthiness? About 95% of people, he has repeatedly found, think themselves better than average. And not just any average, the average Stanford business student. Others may not be good judges of character, but the students, well, they can rate not just trustworthiness, but reliability, honesty, and fairness. Over 3/4 of the class rank themselves in the top quarter on their character reading ability, and a fifth place themselves firmly in the top 10%. We are confident that we can judge how sound of character someone is, and the moment they prove us right, it will take a miracle for them to lose that trust. The same morning that the Franklin Syndicate hit $1.2 million in investments, November 24th, 1889, it hit another landmark, a lead headline in the New York Times. That is, a legitimate article, not one of Miller's own paid adverts. It ran at a cool three words, exhorting people to no uncertain action. Desert Miller's Company. Leading financiers, the story said, were asking questions about the venture. Who was the backer? Where were the deposits being invested? From whence the consistently dazzling returns? 4 days earlier, a Franklin syndicate did indeed apply for incorporation in New Jersey, investigators had found, but none of those concerned knew anything of Miller. I know nothing of Mr. Miller, of his business affairs, or of the statements contained in the papers as to what he is doing in Brooklyn, Howard Wood, the secretary of the Corporation Trust of New Jersey, told the press. From there, it only got dicier. They have no officers, there is no general manager, they could only do business outside New Jersey through a vote of the board of directors, which has never met, for the reason that there are no directors. Miller's fantastical returns had been catching the eyes of journalists for several months. Even as the syndicate heated up, so too did the scrutiny surrounding its investments, its methods, its financial soundness. Repeatedly, reporters had come to Miller's door, poking, probing, demanding answers and financial statements. The headline of November 24th was the culmination of the effort. And so, that Friday night, as markets shut down for the weekend and subscribers retired for a two-day break, Miller fled north, arriving in Canada before the week was out. As Miller was making his way northward, the police were closing in on his operation. Hours after he'd left, they arrived to find the house on Floyd Street bereft of its proprietors. Cecil Leslie, Miller's public face and press officer, was also nowhere to be seen. Gone was Schlesinger, his partner. The owners, it seemed, had left in a hurry. There was $4,500 just lying there on the table, next to $400 worth of stamped envelopes. There was a large safe, unopened, in the corner. There were some clerks and secretaries, 45 or so, wandering around in a bewildered haze. They had stuck around for payday. Where were their checks? That evening, a crowd of thousands, 2,000 according to one account, swarmed the syndicate. They weren't particularly anxious, merely curious. Past 6 o'clock, they were making their deposits, $50 here, $100 there. True, earlier in the day some had demanded refunds, but the tide had turned. A few loudmouthed men had screamed at the clerks to return their money, promptly received the entire sum, and then sheepishly returned a second time to ask if it could be redeposited. They apologized for being hasty and untrusting. Soon, the demands for returns, about 100 at last count, began to turn into further deposits, and the tide of trust kept rising. "Why, Mr. Miller has never failed us," said one woman who'd been lingering outside. "He's always paid dividends. I put in $100 6 weeks ago and have taken 60 out. It is these newspapers and bankers that are causing this trouble. Nobody believes the papers," she continued. "It's envy. They'd like to make money themselves." "Investing with Miller was the best thing that ever happened," affirmed the local druggist, H.M. Ulig. A young woman who'd persuaded three of her friends to go in with her on the scheme agreed. She'd come that afternoon with the goal of investing further. "She was being a fool," someone warned. She replied confidently, "No, never. Mr. Miller will always do as he says." At the livery stable around the corner, where all the employees had invested with the syndicate, an elderly German reassured onlookers. "Miller's all right," he told the New York Times. "He can have anything he wants in this section. We'd send him to the legislature if he wanted to go." A local tailor, Adolf Bremen, had closed his business on the strength of Miller's dividends, $75 a week for 2 weeks. He was confident the sums would continue to arrive. On Saturday, a crowd of some 200 to 400 lingered outside the office. "Closed on Saturday," read the sign, as it always had. The crowd seemed reassured. After all, Mr. Miller never came in on Saturdays. Why today? Mrs. Charlton, a Brooklyn sweatshop worker who toiled 12 hours a day for 56 cents, anxiously surveyed the crowd. Just 2 weeks earlier, she had put $160, her entire life savings in Mr. Miller's keeping. She'd received $32 back, dividends for 2 weeks. Would her money be lost? She anxiously asked the gathered onlookers. No, they told her. It was all a plot against poor Mr. Miller. Reassured, she went on her way. As the afternoon wore on, more investors arrived. There was Carl Pruce, a cripple, who proudly displayed his receipts for $450 from the day before. He wasn't anxious, no sir. He was just seeing what all the hubbub was about, and he'd be back early Monday, you could count on it, to receive his first week's dividend. There was an equally confident H.D. Strunk, investment $500. He was a grocer from down the road, and Mr. Miller had always been as good as his word. There was the confectioner, Frank Weinstein, who'd invested $50 and had, just the day before, convinced his cousin that this was the safest place by far for his $200. There was a delicatessen dealer, August Weber, so confident in Miller's returns that he'd also secured investments from his wife and mother-in-law. So large was his deposit that he refused to divulge it, as those around him had so proudly done. "That's none of your business," he retorted. "But I tell you that if Mr. Miller wants $500 from me on Monday, he can have it." And there was Miss Walford, there to deposit another $50 to double her account and returns both. She wasn't much of a reader of papers. Mr. Miller fled and unable to take her money? Nonsense, she wouldn't hear of it. It wasn't just the locals either. Policemen, firemen, detectives, mailmen, all had, up until the last, received dividends from Miller. "If the officers are not afraid," chanced someone in the crowd, "why should we be?" On Monday morning, when the anxious account holders gathered to receive their funds, they found the house taken over by the police. And yet, even now, they didn't panic. So strong was Miller's pull and their optimism, born out of experience and necessity, that they maintained a quasi-religious faith in his return. It would all prove to be a misunderstanding. Tradesmen, neighborhood housewives, members of his church, all crowded Floyd Street, but only to be there when he returned. It was the newspapers, they repeated, that were the true culprits. They had cast such deep, unfounded aspersions that, of course, Miller was forced to flee. It seemed yesterday as if the majority of the crowd gathered in front of 144 Floyd Street were awaiting his return, wrote the New York Times on November 27th, 4 days after Miller's flight, to be followed by the announcement that the syndicate would resume business promptly and that he would confound all his enemies. Captain Lees, the district captain who had been among the earliest skeptics of Miller's venture, sought in vain for someone to pull the trigger on his illegitimacy. "I have yet to hear any of that man's customers speak against him. They all believe in his honesty and cannot be convinced that his business methods are crooked," he said. Brooklyn Detective James Reynolds added, "The people in the neighborhood all had faith in him, and many of the merchants there honor his checks even now. The principal feeling among these people is one of animosity to the newspapers for destroying what the people thought was a good thing." On November 28th, 5 days after Miller's disappearance, press at a high and police search going strong, his investors remained undeterred. Letters filled with cash, hopeful investments for when Miller returned and the syndicate resumed, as it surely would, its daily operations, flooded the Brooklyn post office. At Station A, at Broadway and Graham, over 1,200 letters awaited the return of the greatest stock manipulator of all time. Nearby, at the main post office, there sat over $10,000 in money orders. And more than a dozen detectives spread their net beyond New York, scanning European freighters, New Jersey trains, anything that might give a sign as to Miller's whereabouts. Crowds gathered on Floyd Street, awaiting the Franklin Syndicate's grand reopening. Unrealistic optimism about the future doesn't just make us think everything will continue to go well if we're seeing returns at this very moment. It also makes us complacent and complacently overconfident, even when we have the chance to get out. It's like Miller's investors who came to withdraw and ended up depositing. The logic is actually quite clear. You are wavering. Maybe things aren't that great. But then you see just a hint of reassurance. Miller's plants, who asked for refunds and then promptly redeposited the cash. A vaunted strategy of the con artist. Work with a gang and make sure plenty of those who look just like the marks are actually nicely paid to string those marks along. And you start the age-old game. What will I regret more? Knowing I'm safe and having missed out on a potentially great investment? Or risking it and knowing that if the fantastic returns continue, I will grow rich along with them? Anticipate an emotion, that is, the emotion we can anticipate feeling if we take a certain course of action, strongly favors the status quo. Anticipated regret makes us want to keep doing what we're doing. Anticipated stress makes us want to cope proactively by not doing anything that might provoke said stress. And anticipated guilt makes us likewise want to prevent it from ever happening. In one of their famous thought experiments, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky described two individuals who'd been playing the stock market. Both had just lost $1,200 on a certain stock. The difference between them was in how they'd lost it. The first had lost it after initially buying one stock, and then, after a bit of thought, switching to another. The second had made the mistake of sticking with a losing stock rather than, after some reflection, switching to a winner. Who would feel worse? Almost without fail, the participants who read the two scenarios thought that the first investor, who'd had a winner and switched to a loser, would feel more regret. The thought that you'd been right all along, if only you'd stuck to your guns, is just too painful for most people to consider. Over a decade later, Maya Bar-Hillel and Efrat Netter demonstrated that the same behavior would hold when it came to actual money. The researchers asked participants to trade a lottery ticket they already had, they'd been handed it at the start of the experiment, for a new one with an equal chance of winning, alongside a delicious chocolate truffle. 3 out of 5 refused to make the trade. The psychologists then sweetened the deal. Not only would they give out new tickets, they'd also give out hard cash to anyone willing to trade theirs in. Even still, fewer than 40% of the participants made the trade. The number fell to a low of just over a quarter, 27%, when the possibility of regret was raised explicitly. There would be a public drawing, and a prior owner would know if her ticket had actually won. Even if the ticket was completely withdrawn from consideration, it couldn't win no matter what. Fewer than half were willing to give it up. It wasn't just about what is known as the endowment effect, the fact that we value what we already have more than we don't, Bar-Hillel and Netter concluded. The possibility of regret loomed so strongly on the chance that the player had given up a winner that it overcame all rational considerations. Trading pens instead of lottery tickets, in fact, an object without any uncertainty surrounding its value, yielded a 90% compliance rate. It wasn't about letting go of what you had. It was about letting go of the chance of winning and having to live with the regret. A 2007 follow-up found that not only were people reluctant to exchange tickets, they actually judged an exchanged ticket more likely to be a winner. The truth is, when things are going according to plan, we are that much more likely to believe the plan a solid one. If we startle, if we run now, if we walk away, we may live to regret it. And then who's the sucker? As they say, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And that is precisely what the confidence artist is depending on in the convincer. The nagging feeling in your gut. What if you scream foul? And it ends up that it wasn't a con after all. Sightings of Miller started popping up around the continent. In early December, a hotel clerk at the Hilago Hotel in Monterrey, Mexico, swore that Miller had checked in with two large suitcases only to depart for Tampico and from there on a boat to Central America. Next, he was arrested and headed back to New York, except it wasn't Miller at all, it was a local reporter. His investors finally started to turn. Elizabeth Timmons, who'd given a $1,000 bond for his bail, asked to be released from it. She wanted no responsibility for his appearance. Bergstrom, his first ever victim, sued him for return of the $150 he'd eventually deposited. On February 8th, Miller, the real one this time, was apprehended in Montreal by Captain James Reynolds. On Tuesday evening, around 7, he had been walking down the street with another man when Reynolds spied him in the crowd. "Hello, Miller. I'm Captain Reynolds of New York," he said as he walked up to the fugitive. Miller doffed his hat. "Why, how are you, Captain?" he replied. They shook hands, Miller smiled, and the captain informed him of his impending travel plans back to the States, preferably with Miller at his side. By 8, the two were speeding on a train back across the border. Just before 2 in the afternoon the following day, Reynolds and Miller arrived at Grand Central Terminal. "Well, Miller, we are in New York now," Reynolds told him. "I will have to place you under arrest." Miller smiled. "Certainly, I understand." Misfortune, it seems, did little to make him less brazen. "Anyone with any common sense would know I was not in Canada," he told a reporter who managed to sneak his way into the jail alongside a lawyer once Miller was safely in custody. "Since I have been connected with this enterprise, I have been pounded like a football by the police, the lawyers, and the reporters." He was the real victim. He'd done nothing but make money for thousands of people. At just past 4 in the afternoon, William Miller arrived at the Brooklyn Municipal Building. He looked as dapper as ever, complete with his usual derby hat, gray covert coat, and black suit of cheviot wool. There, a crowd awaited. Head hung, Miller made his way up the steps, dwarfed by Reynolds at his side. The crowd closed in behind him, following closely on his heels. The courtroom, meanwhile, had filled well past capacity, each seat taken, the aisles crammed with onlookers. As Miller stood before the court, Judge Hurd read back his indictment. 2 counts of grand larceny in the first degree, and 1 in the second. There was no syndicate. There were no shares. Miller hadn't invested in the stock market. He wasn't even a member of the stock exchange. Actually, that's not entirely true. He did invest once. As the Franklin Syndicate took off, Miller seems to have bought some of his own lies and invested $1,000 on some shares he was certain would go up. Wasn't he the one with the inner edge, after all, the genius of Wall Street? At the end of the week, the investment had indeed changed significantly in value. It was worth $5.36. Miller's was one of the earliest and most successful of what we now call Ponzi schemes in history. Only back then, Charles Ponzi would have still been a 17-year-old kid. Take from Peter to give to Paul. All well and good while you have a steady supply of capital. Not so good if that supply dries up. He'd netted what today would be worth over $25 million. The whole scheme was fraudulent and felonious, the court documents read. Miller's intent to cheat and defraud. He'd committed grand larceny and crime of false pretense. "Not guilty," came Miller's plea. As the courtroom cleared, Miller was brought to a small cage next door. For the next hour, he sat quietly on a chair in the corner, reading the paper, joking with his guards. Just past 6, he was returned to jail, cell 6, Tier B, Raymond Street. On April 30th, Miller was sentenced to 10 years in Sing Sing. It was the maximum penalty possible by law. Miller was crushed. His lawyer had begged for clemency. The judge stood firm. "It is a grave question whether an enterprise like the one this man carried on ought to be suppressed by the severest punishment under the law. I am of the opinion that it should." "Yes, Judge Jenks," Hirschberg said, "the victims were ignorant and unthinking. Who could believe in someone nicknamed 520% for his unparalleled rate of return? It practically screamed fraud. But Miller's sins were vast, and he had to pay." The man who stood in front of the courtroom in June 1903 was no longer the dapper gentleman who had lured thousands of victims into parting with millions. Bent and broken from long illness, a cough racking his body, just the other week he'd suffered a near-fatal hemorrhage in his cell, It was all Miller could do to remain upright during his 3 days' testimony. He was testifying now against his partner, his lawyer, Colonel Robert Ammon. In exchange, he hoped for an early release. As he geared up for his final appearance, crossing the so-called Bridge of Sighs, Miller collapsed, the only thing keeping him from the void, the grip of 2 prison guards on his forearms. Any bitterness I may have felt against Mr. Ammon has been counteracted by my knowledge of what it means to suffer in prison, he concluded his testimony. I am here to tell the truth, regardless of whether it convicts or acquits Mr. Ammon. On Friday, February 10th, 1905, Miller was pardoned for his cooperation. Ammon replaced him in the cells of Sing Sing. For the next decade, Miller lived quietly in Rockwell Center, working as a grocer under the name Williams Schmidt, the last name borrowed from his brother-in-law. His notoriety remained hidden until he and Schmidt quarreled. Miller had him arrested for assault, and in retaliation, Schmidt outed him to neighbors and press. I had to have an alias, Miller later said, or else I never would have been able to earn an honest living. Nobody would have trusted Miller, but as Schmidt I got along fairly well. Meanwhile, Miller's scheme lived on, albeit in new hands. One, the Washington Syndicate Company, even promised the same weekly 10% return. Hadn't investors been deterred by Miller? An inveterate reporter asked the new manager. Don't you, as a businessman, know that it is impossible for anyone to make 10% a week regularly on money in Wall Street or anywhere else? I don't know any such thing, he replied. I've heard of men making 100% a day in Wall Street, and I've seen it figured out how it can be done. But I couldn't do it myself because I don't know anything about stocks. I guess Mr. Lamont knows what he's doing. And what of the fact that the enterprise was the exact same scheme as Miller's had been? Well, it isn't just the same, came the reply. But what if it was? Nobody knows that Miller won't come back and go on with the business. I've heard today that people are offering 50 cents on the dollar for Miller's certificates of deposit, so I guess some believe in him yet, in spite of the newspapers. Optimistic biases are among the strongest we experience. And so, just as the convincer is irresistible to the mark, so too can it prove the downfall of the con artist. The lure of success is simply that powerful. Many con artists operate for years, decades even. Miller rose and fell quickly, true. But Miller's partner at heart, Bernie Madoff, operated his Peter to Paul game for over a decade by the most conservative estimates. And our old friend Fred DeMara conned his way through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, until being forced by circumstance to go straight. The longer a grifter operates in some sense, the more likely he is to overshoot. By the time we hear of a scheme, it may appear incredible. We find it difficult to believe that someone could honestly hope to get away with it. But the logic of the convincer sweeps up many a grifter. It took a long time to get so brazen. Miller's example makes the case perfectly. This scheme in its infancy was quite moderate to an extent, but grew by what it fed upon, wrote Judge Goodrich in a dissenting opinion on Miller's appeal. $10 isn't brazen. $1.2 million is. Jonah Lehrer, the journalist who had 2 books recalled for containing fabrications and willful factual misrepresentations, was finally brought down by falsifying not just anything, but quotes from Bob Dylan. Dylan is still alive, and Dylan fans are a loyal bunch hanging on to the master's every word. When the lies were uncovered, people's reaction was disbelief. How could someone be so brazen? The answer is exactly the same as in Miller's case. Lehrer didn't start by fabricating Dylan. He started with a $10 equivalent. But for years, no one caught on. By the time of the Dylan fiasco, he'd likely fancied himself invincible. The confidence artists can grow as complacent and overconfident as those they deceive. I can keep going forever. I'm good, and things are good, and so it will stay. Catch me if you can. And sometimes this mentality is exactly what does catch them. Had they only stayed more modest, perhaps we'd be none the wiser. Miller wasn't quite destitute during his Long Island days, but he came fairly close. How? Where had the money gone? Much of it was never recovered, and the investors were never fully paid back. According to author Mitchell Zukov, his investors were able to get back, on average, 28 cents on the dollar. Miller had grown so confident that he'd fallen for a little trick of confidence of his own. Before leaving for Canada, he had signed over all of the proceeds of the syndicate to his lawyer, Robert Ammon, including some $200,000 in bonds, a total, as he would later tell the court, of $255,000. "Trust me," Ammon had told Miller. "Because of attorney-client privilege, the money would be safe. He'd take care of everything." Miller had only ever gotten $5,000 back. $5,000 more had gone, according to Ammon, to fixing a few problematic people, and $5,000 had gone toward bribing a jury. And for guarding the funds, Ammon also agreed to look after Miller's wife still in Brooklyn. He gave her a princely allowance of $5 a week. It starts with one word, one quote, one scene, one massaged fact, one altered data point. Did anyone notice? No one? Then let's keep going. Soon the ruse takes on a life of its own, and you're fabricating whole fictional worlds as you bring ever more dupes into the fray. You're not a psychopath. You're probably not even a pathological liar. You're just a grifter who got a bit too enamored of his own scheme and too certain of his own success to believe he can ever fail. And when you're caught, you still can't quite believe it, just as Miller's victims to the end refused to believe they would never see their money again. It's just too, well, unbelievable. The convincer has played its role only too well. There's too much at stake. Things had been going so well. It must be a mistake, not the end. And just as the crowds insisted on Miller's honesty, so the con artist caught in his own web insists on his. You protest your innocence until the point where to keep on protesting would signal a final break with reality. For profit isn't all about money. It's about gaining an edge. Sometimes a financial edge, yes, but also a cognitive edge, a reputational edge, a personal edge. And when we see that edge in our grasp, we hold on to it, and we don't ever want to let it go. Chapter 7, The Breakdown. And the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes, wobbling, back to the fire. Rudyard Kipling. James Franklin Norfleet, Frank, sank back into the plush chair in the lobby of the Adolphus Hotel. It was early November, and it had been a long few days. He needed the rest. He'd been staying at the St. George, arriving just 2 days prior in order to sell off one of his farms. Stocky and compact, just 5'5" in his bare feet, his blue eyes wide set on a broad face, a frosty bark of a voice, punctuated by frequent bursts of laughter that belied his handiness with bulls, horses, and firearms alike. Fast on the draw and a deadly sharpshooter, as one acquaintance put it, Frank was a rancher, Texas-born and bred. He owned a big swath of land up near Hale County, just north of Lubbock, and was in Dallas to sell over 2,000 acres of his land in exchange for the cash to buy a much larger parcel, 10,000 acres immediately across the way, from its owner, Captain Dick Slaughter. Norfleet was 54 years old, and business was good. On his way to Dallas, he'd sold a load of mules. Here, he hoped to sell the land, too. That would get him where he wanted. He hated debts, credit, all of it. He was a cash man, and soon he'd have enough to close the deal. It couldn't come soon enough. He was feeling lonely, and home pulled at him. He did hate the big city. It was at the St. George that, just a few days earlier, Frank had met R. Miller, a mule buyer from Hill County, just outside Dallas, and no relation to the Franklin Syndicate. He'd seen many a mule and grain car from West Texas, Miller told Frank, but had never been there himself. What was it like? Norfleet described the flatlands, the sandy patches and the playas, the loamy soil, the way the ranch rambled on into the distance. He mentioned, too, that he was looking to sell a tract of his land up there. "Norfleet, I may help you," Miller exclaimed. It was Frank's lucky day. A friend of Miller's, W.B. Spencer, was actually a purchasing agent with the Green Immigration Land Company of Minneapolis. He was just that day closing on a patch of land, also 2,000 acres, as luck would have it, in Williamson County, but it looked like the deal would fall through. "It is just possible he might be interested in your place as well," Miller concluded. After a fortuitous introduction and a few false starts, Miller's intuition panned out. Spencer was eager to buy Norfleet's land. Norfleet was thrilled. He'd liked Spencer from the first, mid-30s, dressed in a simple business suit, elegant but not too flashy, just the sort of straight shooter he fancied himself to be and liked in turn to deal with. So taken was he with his new acquaintance and business partner that he readily agreed to share Spencer's hotel room rather than stay on in his own. When Spencer told Norfleet he was staying in a double room at the nearby Jefferson, foolishly stuck with a needlessly large accommodation after the friend he was to share it with had been detained at the last moment, it seemed a natural decision. The reasonable and frugal thing to do. Norfleet was always careful about money. You didn't get to where he was if you weren't. And besides, he really liked Spencer. He welcomed the chance to get to know him better. Plus, it was a buffer against the city loneliness. Later that day, the two men made their way to the Adolphus Hotel to meet with Spencer's boss and see if they couldn't come to an understanding about the land. It was there that Norfleet was sitting as he leaned contentedly into the chair. Something disturbed his back. A stray magazine left behind by a careless reader, he thought, and shuffled forward to remove it. But it wasn't a magazine at all. It was a wallet. It was fat, filled with cash, over $200 in fact, no mean sum at all. And alongside it, a copy of a shockingly large bond for $100,000. In the front, there was a Masonic membership card. J.B. Stetson, it read. The rest of the contents seemed to confirm that this was Stetson's wallet. There was a membership card for the United Brokers, and on the bond, a promise of guaranteed performance by the same Stetson. Norfleet was an honest man. He set about trying to return the property, whoever Stetson might turn out to be. He tried the front desk. Indeed, there was a Mr. Stetson registered, and he happened to be in his room at the moment. Norfleet and Spencer made their way up. Frank knocked on the door. "Excuse me," he asked as the door opened a slit. "Have you lost anything?" "No," came the curt reply. The door slammed in Norfleet's astounded face. He turned to go back to the elevator. As he and Spencer reached the end of the hallway, a voice cried out after them. "Gentlemen, gentlemen," it said, "I have just discovered that I have lost a very, very valuable pocketbook." The men returned. Stetson invited them in. First, he wanted to apologize. He had mistaken them for reporters. The bloody bastards had been hounding him all afternoon. But he was beyond ecstatic to make their acquaintance. The cash was good to get back, sure, but the real prize was his Masonic membership card. He was so very happy to have it once more safely in his pocket. Norfleet understood. He was a fellow Mason. So glad was Stetson to be reunited with his property that he offered both men a $100 reward. Spencer eagerly pocketed the cash to Norfleet's surprise. Norfleet politely refused. Sure, it was a lot of money, but he was only doing his duty. The pleasure of seeing Stetson's relief was reward enough. But Stetson insisted. He wanted to show his gratitude. You know what he would do? He would take the $100 and invest it on the rancher's behalf. It was his profession, he made huge returns, and normally his investment advice came at a high price. But in this case, he would make an exception. He had just received a tip, and he could act quickly. Would Norfleet take any winnings from his investment? Norfleet agreed. It seemed a good compromise. Stetson left to place some calls and make some bets. Spencer lounged behind Stetson's vacated desk. Norfleet paced the room and took stock of their surroundings. Several impressive-looking wardrobes overflowing with fine garments and shoes. A solid desk stacked with papers and stock reports, cryptograms and keys,